Welcome to Entwine Podcast. Before we get started, I wanted to gently suggest you head on over to the website to get signed up to receive our semi-regular newsletter. This newsletter isn't fresh out of the oven chocolate chip cookie goodness, but McKay and I think you'll find it's pretty darn close. For our US listeners, you may have noticed the annual obligatory tax event has come and gone, which means the Entwine Podcast just entered year number two. Those of you outside the US can take comfort in knowing that aside from Tax Day, it was Rubber Eraser Day, Titanic Remembrance Day, Vimy Ridge Day, and my personal favorite, Husband Appreciation Day. Exciting, right? A lot has happened in a year, aside from the 28 episodes, and we appreciate you as listeners for all your feedback and support. If you have been dying to become a producer of the show, then you need to check out our Patreon page and get signed up. McKay loves getting the iTunes reviews you leave us tattooed on his buttocks, so please keep those coming. Remember, we are not begging for good reviews, just help us capture a few honest ones. So, yeah, that's about it. Thank you all so very much, and stay twined. As part of normal podcast business, I find myself banging away on a laptop for hours, twisting together moments in history with the hopes of sharing something new and interesting. In the years since we started this show, my process hasn't changed much. Open a Microsoft Word document, change the paragraph settings for aesthetics, and then save the document with the episode number. Seriously, as habitual as it sounds, this really is how these things get started. And once the page is ready, I pretty much sit and stare at it for 30 minutes. Typing and retyping the same few sentences over and over and over again. Optimistic, the opening sets the stage for the words to follow. My weapon of choice? A white HP Pavilion with a backlit keyboard, acquired on the cheap from a local Costco. A computer is a complicated thing. Besides time, a lot went into the decision to purchase it. Hefting the samples while walking the counter in circles, one hand on my chin as I scrutinize the labels looking for the very best deal. With so many technical details to consider, it isn't surprising I showed no deference to the feel and the sound of the keyboard as I grabbed the purchase card for the item I select. It's not a bad machine, it works, and serves its purpose about as well as the microwave or the toaster. Don't get me wrong, I appreciate it for its utility, but the keys are flat, and when depressed, they emit a sharp, plastic click, not conducive to the creative process. An amazingly unsatisfying typing experience, to say the least. But guess what? There are a few companies out there making programs specifically designed to acoustically improve the computer typing experience. For just a few bucks, and sometimes for no bucks, you can make your keystrokes sound like you are using a typewriter. I've tried the free stuff and they're a bit clunky because if you type at a decent pace, the clicks merge together for a sluggishly dull sounding experience. Despite the program's funky weirdness, there is something inherently appealing about the steady click of the typewriter. I'm almost 40 and yes, I've used a typewriter before, but almost all of my practice over time has been on what could be considered the modern day equivalent. Apple IIe, laptops, fancy USB keyboards, I've used and tried them all. For typing purists, or maybe elitist is a better word, there is no substitute for typing or sending a letter on a typewriter. It's true. In 2017, there are still people out there who collect and use manual typewriters on a regular basis. You can pick most of them up for less than 50 bucks, and if you have the time and a little oil, you can get it working as originally intended. One of those people is Tom Hanks, who claims to use a typewriter daily to send letters, thank you notes, create lists, and even hash out rough drafts. In 2013, Mr. Hanks wrote an editorial for the New York Times where he said, "The tactile pleasure of typing old school is incomparable." You see, he loves these machines, collects them, and even has been known to give them as presents. In an homage to the word processing dinosaurs, Hanks collaborated with a well-known application developer, HitSense, to create an iPad app to simulate the look, feel, and sound of old-fashioned typing, officially called the Hanks Writer. Besides having a fetish for manual typewriters, Tom Hanks is also well known for acting, with most of his movies becoming instant classics. Known most famously for his work on Forrest Gump, Apollo 13, Castaway, Big, and The Green Mile, it's hard to find someone who doesn't know who he is. And despite passing on leading roles in Jerry Maguire and The Shawshank Redemption, he has become one of the highest grossing actors of all time. Tom Hanks was born in 1956 in Concord, California, to parents who would divorce just 5 short years later, and Tom would end up living with his father. Tom grew up in the East Bay and would eventually give community college a shot, which is where he discovered his fondness for acting. Tom would get married, not to Rita Wilson, have a pair of children, and land himself in Ohio, where he worked mostly on Shakespeare productions. In 1984, Hanks burst onto the scene with his performance in the critically acclaimed film Splash. A slew of films would follow, and in 1987, he would find himself divorced, only to be married a year later to his now wife, Rita Wilson. This was an important time for Hanks because in 1988, he would have his first major hit role playing Josh Baskin in the movie Big. This is the moment when Tom Hanks became a household name, and he began to get more and more diverse roles. Even when a film was below average, the critics would always reference Hanks acting as the bright spot. Fast forward another 10 years to when Tom teamed up with Sleepless in Seattle and Joe vs. the Volcano co-star Meg Ryan in the popular romantic comedy You've Got Mail.
You've Got Mail.
Looking back on You've Got Mail, it's a wonder that the film was as intriguing to audiences as it ended up being. Nowadays, we look at the story of love and the internet as dated, and because so much changed so fast, it only represents a small window of time. But the story was interesting, and the characters reflected how many of us digging AOL discs out of the mail were struggling to understand what the World Wide Web actually was. In fact, Meg Ryan didn't even own a computer before she was cast in the part for the film. Let me give you a summary for those of you who have never seen or heard of this film. Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan start up an internet romance through chat and email using the popular service America Online, or AOL. The two meet in real life as business rivals, but don't realize they are face to face with the person that they have been chatting with online. There are funny moments, there are tender moments, and it all ends as it should. For most of the movie, Meg Ryan is dating Greg Kinnear, who is a columnist for the New York Observer. Kinnear's character is highly intelligent and slightly obsessive-compulsive, who uses his column in The Observer to warn the population of the effects of technology and what it's doing to society. Where Meg Ryan's character is keen on using a computer, her boyfriend Kinnear is dedicated to his manual typewriter. The character is seen discussing, using, and even gifting this typewriter throughout the film for the same reasons Mr. Hanks and myself have mentioned. Kinnear's character is based on Ron Rosenbaum, a real person who worked for the New York Times, among other publications, and believe it or not, had an interesting relationship with his typewriter. Rosenbaum would be well known for writing about Hitler, Shakespeare, religion, and capital punishment, and many of these topics were drafted on his Olympia Report Deluxe typewriter. The film provides postage stamp level recognition to what could be considered the big bang of what the internet has become today. The concept of the typewriter itself dates back to the 1500s, with the closest relative being thought up and patented by Henry Mill in 1714. The patent was a rough sketch and idea around how to transcribe letters, and in the 150 years that would follow, several others would have an attempt at the machine. One of the more interesting and weird-looking inventions was the Hanson writing ball. The Hanson writing ball was just that, a ball-shaped device where the paper would be loaded on the underside and the user would press the keys to reach the desired effect. It's actually kind of a neat idea, but it seems highly inefficient when put to actual use. Eventually, a man editing copy for the Kenosha Telegraph named Christopher Latham Scholes would team up with a few others to create what is widely accepted as the first typewriter. During a newspaper strike at the Telegraph, Scholes needed to find solutions to automate production to help meet deadlines. Scholes tweaked older concepts in an effort to number the pages of publications, which would eventually evolve into the machine being able to incorporate letters and words. Scholes would fine-tune the device over the next few years and undoubtedly use it while he worked as a reporter and politician in the state of Wisconsin. I was interested to find out that Scholes was appointed by Abraham Lincoln to be the collector of the Port of Milwaukee, a job that was a lot different than some of his other occupations over the years. Some say his role as collector helped springboard him into civil service. Another one of the interesting things about Scholes, aside from inventing the modern typewriter, was that he served as both a Democrat and a Republican in the Wisconsin State Senate. In addition to playing both sides of the aisles, there was a year where he was a Wisconsin State Assemblyman, making it onto the ticket with the Free Soil Party. The Free Soil Party, and yes, this was actually a thing, was mostly made up of folks from northern states who had left the Liberty Party and the Barn Burners. The Free Soil Democrats opposed the extension of slavery into the territories and wanted taxes to be spent on national improvements. Oh, that, and they also wanted cheap postage. While reporting for the Kenosha Telegraph, Christopher Scholes attended and chronicled the trial of John McCaffrey, who was an Irish immigrant farmer living in Kenosha County, Wisconsin. McCaffrey was on trial for murder of his wife, where it was proven he had drowned her in a cistern on their Wisconsin farm. Scholes reported on the matter in part because he was against capital punishment, and it was possible that a guilty verdict would come with a death sentence. In the end, McCaffrey was found guilty of willful murder and sentenced to be hung by the neck until dead. Almost 3,000 people gathered to witness the first public execution to be performed in the state of Wisconsin. I am sure there were other executions, but this was the first officially state-sanctioned and directed execution as the result of a trial. Before the hangman's hood was placed over his head, McCaffrey admitted his guilt and warned spectators not to behave as he had. Unfortunately, like many other early executions, this was not a quick and painless process for McCaffrey, and it took almost 20 full minutes for the man to be declared dead. Scholes, who was in attendance, wrote about the event in the Kenosha Telegraph and said, quote, "We do not complain that the law has been enforced. We complain that the law exists. Let another system of punishment be adopted and other means used to reform the criminal," end quote. The hanging had made such a spectacle, it started to garner the attention of several groups who, like Christopher Scholes, were working to abolish capital punishment. Eventually, a bill in opposition of prisoner execution landed on the governor of Wisconsin's desk for review. The man in charge at the time was Leonard J. Farwell, who came from an extremely humble beginning to ultimately rise up and become governor. Farwell accomplished a lot while serving the great state of Wisconsin and would create policy to strengthen public schools, the historical society, and the state university system. Farwell would sign the grassroots bill into law, which in effect abolished capital punishment for all crimes, a law, despite being heavily debated, which is still in place today. John McCaffrey would end up being the only person in history to be executed in the state of Wisconsin, largely in part to the efforts of Farwell and Christopher Scholes. Scholes would continue to develop his typing machine and make changes and improvements until he created something almost all of us can easily recognize, the QWERTY keyboard. You may have never realized this, but the word QWERTY isn't a word. It's essentially a group of letters associated with the layout on the top left of the keyboard. QWERTY. Scholes first had the letters lined up like piano keys in two rows, but typing in that format proved to be slow and inaccurate. He gifted QWERTY to the world, and amazingly enough, it is still the standard used on computers and virtual keyboards today. Christopher Scholes wasn't doing these improvements for nothing. He was working to add value to his patent and hopefully attract the attention of investors to help produce the machine for the general public to purchase. Considering typewriters were eventually mass-produced, it may come as no shock to hear he decided to sell his idea and the patent to a company who promised to manufacture his idea within the year. Scholes agreed to sell his part in the company for a mere $1,200 to a company called E. Remington & Sons. Remington had been much more well known for manufacturing sewing machines, farm tools, and firearms. Yep, E. Remington & Sons eventually became the Remington Arms Company, which still makes handguns and rifles today. So here's how the legend goes. Ephelet Remington II wanted to impress his pops, and he knew that he could craft a better rifle than what was available on the market at the time. So he works hard and spends countless hours in his father's forge to eventually put together a working gun. Remington decides to enter a competition, which in my head looks a lot like the cartoon version of the archery scene from Disney's The Robin Hood. Despite being unknown and using a homemade weapon, he comes in second place. Sales immediately begin to skyrocket, and before anyone knew what was going on, Remington was thrusted into the gun business. The company began making breech-loading firearms for the U.S. Army, and shortly after began to diversify their holdings to include agricultural implements, sewing machines, and the Remington typewriter. Remington would be the first company to commercialize and produce the modern manual typewriter, which sold for around $250 and promised to substantially speed up the writing process. And if you plug that into an internet inflation calculator, you will see that $250 to buy the first typewriter would be the same as spending $5,000 of 2017 money. Remington would also be well known for producing a weapon called the Remington Derringer, which was a gun originally designed by Henry Derringer. The Derringer was a small pocket pistol designed to be easy to conceal. Many of the first Derringers were muzzle-loading, capable of holding a single shot and often toted around by women in stockings. They have changed a lot over time, often incorporating additional barrels, smokeless powder, and cartridges, but the main principle of the device remained true. It was tremendously easy to hide. In fact, this Derringer pocket pistol was the same weapon John Wilkes Booth used in the assassination of President Abraham Lincoln. The assassination of President Lincoln was a major event in history, and there were several in attendance that night at Ford's Theater. So many had shown up to watch the play Our American Cousin, but it was the attendance of Governor Leonard Farwell who has the greatest impact on this story. You see, Farwell was in attendance as largely in part to being recently appointed to the role of assistant examiner at the U.S. Patent Office by Lincoln, and maybe he was at Ford's Theater to impress his new boss. Farwell would be rushed from the theater and eventually be the first person to meet with Vice President Andrew Johnson about the terrible event. Farwell seemed to be the take-charge type and ordered Johnson to be protected. So get this. The guards found a knife and a gun in one of the adjacent rooms, and Leonard Farwell has been referred to as saving the vice president's life as a direct result of how quickly he acted after Lincoln was shot. The very same Leonard Farwell who signed into law the abolition of the death penalty in Wisconsin just a few years earlier. This all feels relatively entwined, but get this. After the assassination, Farwell moved to Chicago, where he lost everything in the Chicago fires, which almost returned him to his humble upbringings. A devastating fire, which was reportedly to have started because a cow kicked over a lantern, and then that fire ate up the Windy City for two straight days, doing over $200 million in damage. One of the few items to be recovered was a painting entitled The Last Hours of President Lincoln. This historic painting depicts the 47 souls who visited President Lincoln before he passed away. If you look up this painting, you will see all 47 people crowded around the president as he lays in the center of the room. Of course, all these people were not actually in the room at the same time, but the artist captures several moments all at once in one perfect rendering. And sure enough, on the right, and one of the only people facing away from the president, you see Leonard Farwell standing there talking to a judge in stunning black and white. The Remington Derringer and their other offerings would continue to be part of American culture for years, but it was the impact of the Remington typewriters which may have had the most profound impact on society. A man with a well-known pseudonym was the very first person to submit a typewritten book manuscript using a Remington typewriter in the years following the machine's production. This well-known author was a man who went by the pen name Mark Twain. Oh, and there were others too. So many are famous for using Remington machines. Heck, there's Agatha Christie, Allen Ginsberg, George Orwell, Langston Hughes, Herman Hesse, and William Faulkner, just to name a few. Those of you who are into the occult, well, H.P. Lovecraft himself was reported to have used a Remington typewriter for many of his works. I open this story with how impactful the reliable report of the typewriter can help spark creativity and keep writers focused while creating their worlds. The feel of the keyboard, or more appropriately, as Mr. Tom Hanks said, the tactile pleasure of typing old school is incomparable. And you know what? He was right. Tom Hanks has over 50 typewriters, and a few of them are undoubtedly made by the Remington Arms Company. I can't help but find humor in the fact that a gun manufacturer also produced the typewriter, which was a machine with a purpose in stark contrast to the ideas that the company was originally founded on. War and peace, or actual war, both could be doled out in spades by a Remington machine. You spend a lot of time learning about history in school. Heck, every grade dedicates time to learn about those men and women who came before us. And you know what? Maybe it was because I elected to skip my second grade Abraham Lincoln report, or maybe it was because of something altogether different, but I never knew that President Lincoln's mother died when he was just 9 years old. His mother, Nancy, married his father, Thomas, and the two would only be married for a decade before she would succumb to milk sickness, which was basically a way of saying that she drank naturally poisoned cow milk. I'm sure it was a terrible time for Abe, as no boy should ever have to grow up without his mother. Nancy Lincoln is also referred to as Nancy Hanks, which was her name before she was married into the Lincoln family. Go ahead and Google it. Nancy Hanks Lincoln is on Wikipedia and about a dozen other websites linking Tom Hanks to the bloodline. In fact, Tom Hanks himself has been quoted as confirming the relationship, and the two are something like third cousins a few times removed. So as you bang away on your laptop or desktop or mobile device, think about what you're missing. As you slowly move your hands around the keyboard and your fingers slide effortlessly between the flat plastic keys, think about the past. Think about the dull plastic click you hear as you send emails and search the internet. Think about the birth of AOL and trying to nail first impressions. Think about the sound you may never, ever hear again, the sound of the typewriter. The same sound and feel Tom Hanks has spent so much time trying to bottle up and keep forever.
Thank you for listening. This has been Entwined. Entwined is a podcast that releases every other week and is written, recorded, edited, and produced by Elliot Gladstone and P.S. McKay. This episode was written by Elliot Gladstone. Please tune in next time to see what P.S. McKay has in store for us. For more information about the show or the authors, please check out entwinedpodcast.com or visit our Twitter page at entwinedpodcast.